Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
People forget that it's an audio broadcast.
John. Right now, before we do anything else.
Yes?
Because you obviously didn't see it yet. Go to our website.
What's the URL again?
Oh my god.
That's just awesome. And disturbing.
A little bit.
But mostly awesome.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And Ben.
And John.
And this week, ladies and gentlemen, is actually an interview that was recorded earlier.
Because I am so awesome.
Yes, yes.
Oh, wait, it's not with me.
Okay. No, it wasn't with Ben. It wasn't with John.
Why would anybody want that?
It's actually an interview that was 2 years in the making, ladies and gentlemen. So a little bit of explanation behind it before we... play it for you. This interview is with Greg Horn, who I have known since about 2008. And we've been friends. And when we started the podcast, he, of course, was one of the first people I asked if he wanted to be on it. And he said, sure, just let me know when. And I kept saying, how about now? And he kept saying, oh, I got to do this. Oh, I got to do that. So this past year at Wizard World Philly, we went out to dinner one night after the con, and I pulled out my phone with my little microphone, put it on the table, and said, all right, we're doing it.
So you cornered him.
Yes, I cornered him.
But the duct tape really wasn't necessary.
No, but he likes the
duct
tape.
But it made it so much more enjoyable for everyone.
So, yes. He did not disappoint, though. He gave a lot of insight into how he got started. Gave some really great stories about his background. And I am not going to, put it out on Front Street, as they say. I'm going to just let the man speak for himself. Just please forgive a little bit of the audio quality. Like I said, we were at a diner, and I used my phone to record this, so it was just sitting on the table, but it's clear for the most part. But of course, there's some background noise, and it doesn't get in the way, but, there were little children in the diner. As Ben and I and John can attest to, that it's not always a good mix to recording.
No, children in any place can be a wild card.
Yes. So, without any further ado, here we go.
So, let's we've talked about this before, and I'm sure you your fans want to know, how did you get started in art?
Well, I got started in art at an early age. My mother was an artist. She had her own studio doing sculptures and mostly fine art type stuff. Mm-hmm. And at a very young age, she started teaching me how to draw. Things like, we live in Florida, so she taught me how to draw palm trees, and she taught me how to draw flamingos. And then that was my basic knowledge of learning. And then when I went to elementary school in third grade, I stopped at a Mr. Grocer, which was kind of like a 7-Eleven.
Okay.
And they had a comic book rack there. This was my first exposure to comic books. And I picked up Green Lantern Corps, Avengers.
Okay.
And Hanna-Barbera's Laugh Olympics. This is a long time ago.
Okay.
And I saw this stuff, and I was like, wow. It immediately hit me how great this was. You had all these characters, colorful characters, running around in spandex. They're all arguing with each other, having battles. And it just immediately inspired me. And I started drawing stuff in class in third grade. And one of the teachers saw that I was drawing and not doing my work. And instead of crushing my dreams, she introduced me to the art teacher, who paired me up with another kid who was in a higher grade. He was in fifth grade. And he started teaching me how to draw Hanna-Barbera characters.
Oh, cool.
So we learned to draw basic cats and dogs. We drew Quick Draw McGraw and Ricochet Rabbit. And somehow I melded the two together. Avengers is my favorite comic book.
Right.
So I made these Avengers copycat characters, but they were morphed with Hanna-Barbera characters. So instead of Wonder Man, you would end up with Wonder Dog.
Okay.
So it was Wonder Man with a dog's head. I had another character that was based on Shang-Chi. His name is Karate Dog.
Karate Dog. Is that a little like Kung Fu? Hung Kung Fu-y,
exactly. And then, instead of Iron Man, I had Metal Man. So that was me getting into comics and
right.
The whole idea of making my own comic book. And from then, I was just drawing comic books all the time. Instead of the Avengers, I had a team called the Justifiers. So it was pretty much just a copycat of
right.
the Avengers.
Well, that's what kids do.
Yeah, and it was great. And then one day I picked up a book and I saw George Perez's art, and I was just immediately hooked on comics forever after that. And from then on, I would say the rest of my learning to draw has been just kind of a natural process of drawing my own comic books and, you know, trying to have fun with it.
Right. It sounds like the key there was you and a teacher that encouraged you.
Absolutely, yes.
I think that's important in anyone's life. You know, it's like, how many times have you heard stories of people like just being told they're not good enough to do something, mm-hmm. or that's what dreamers do, or you can play drums, but you need a career to fall back on. You know,
yes.
You know, it's just, you have to be thankful to have people in your life to go, yeah, you know, so, what, you're pretty good. Let's...
Yeah, definitely a pivotal moment in my life. Now, the same teacher did tell us that by the time we got to college, we would be living on Mars.
Oh, well.
So.
She was a dreamer.
It was kind of hit or miss with her.
Well, you know, I mean, hey, people have dreams. You know, we'll get to Mars eventually.
Sure.
Actually, wait. They have they do have that program that
I know they got the rover.
No, but there was a like, in Switzerland or something, they were having a program where they were going to launch people into space to colonize Mars.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so.
So then, obviously, right, you loved it from there. What was your first professional foray into comics, though?
Well,
I don't think a lot of people know about this.
Well, as I had mentioned, from third grade on, I was pretty much just drawing my own comic books.
Right.
A bunch of my friends caught on to it, and pretty soon we had like our own comic company running. It was called Great Comics. And all my buddies, we would draw comics, and we would have crossovers and big events. We had an event called The Final Conflict. So I just kept drawing and drawing and drawing. And then finally, around the age of 17, my mother brought me a newspaper article. And it had a feature on a comic book publisher. His name was Bill Black, and he worked out of Florida, which is where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing a book. His company was called AC Comics, and he had a comic book called Femme Force.
Okay.
It was an all-female team. So my mom said, you know what, you should do a comic book and send it to him. I'll find out his address. You mail it to him up in Central Florida. So I said, oh, okay, Mom, sounds like a good idea. So I drew a storyline, you know, with their characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mailed it up there, and sure enough, I got a call back, and he wanted me to do a comic book.
Wow.
17 years old. So the first comic book I ever worked on was Femme Force 19. I believe this is like back in 1990s.
Okay.
Like quite some time ago. And I would say... I mean, I was already interested in drawing women, but
right,
I was not
right.
very good at it. And this Femme Force book kind of forced me to learn how to draw females.
Right.
And females are much more difficult to draw than the male characters because there's not a lot of margin for error. You know, like if I'm drawing Wolverine, I can literally drop my pencil on his face and it's okay. It's gonna look like some character mark.
Right, right.
You know, but when you're drawing a girl character, there's a lot more you gotta take a lot more care with it.
Yes.
So I was very thankful to get that job, you know, looking back at it.
Right.
And then after that, I had told him that my favorite holiday was Halloween, and it was coming up. And I said, why don't we do a Halloween special?
Okay.
And they were like, yeah, okay. And I said, would it be okay if I write it? I'm 17 years old.
Right.
And they go, you know what? Send in your story, and then if we like it, yeah, we'll do it. So I sent in the story. They had to do some reworking on it. But at the tender age of 17, I had written and drawn my own comic book.
Wow.
It was called Femme Force in the House of Horror.
Okay.
It's pretty wild. Essentially, they go to a carnival, a
right.
fair, and they have there's a haunted house there, and they decide to ride, but their hated enemies are hiding inside the House of Horror and trying to kill them for real.
So, AC Comics, I never heard of them before, so I assume they're not around anymore either.
I think they're still around. They publish mostly Westerns now.
They
take old Western books from the 40s and 50s, and they reprint them. At the time I started working with them, they were the longest running independent comic company in the United States. I believe when I first started working for them, they had already been in business like 25 years or so.
Cool. So... So that's,
and you don't know who they are. Isn't that sad?
Well, I was going to say, you know, where can someone... That's what I want to know. Where can I find some of these books? Do they exist anywhere anymore?
Wow. I mean, trying to find them in a comic book shop would probably be next to impossible.
Yeah.
Ah, he just found one online there.
Oh, wow. Is that Greg's work?
Yep, that is... that's number 19 right there. Wow. I would... If you wanted to find them, I guess I would try and look them up on eBay or... Or maybe if AC Comics is still in business, maybe you can get back issues.
Yeah. So you were a 17-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. You had your first comic book that you wrote and drew published.
Yes.
I have to imagine at 17, you start thinking, oh, wow, I'm great. Like, I know everything I need to know.
That is a great segue.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what, you know, because I know the story, but I'm trying to, you know, pull it out of you. So,
right.
So what happened after that?
Well, that is true. I thought I was the master of my own destiny. But the truth was, I was not very good. But I thought I was great. So anyway, Bill comes up to me and says, I asked him, hey, when are we going to do the next comic? And he says, you know, we're thinking about going in a new direction. I've got this guy that's working for me, the Count. His name was The Count.
Okay.
And we want to try him out, and yeah, he works really cheap, and he's a great artist. So I really think you should think about going to art school, because I had just graduated high school.
Right.
By the time these two books were done, I had graduated high school. And he says, yeah, you should think about going to art school. And at the time, he was kind of a father figure to me. My father had left when I was about 12 years old. And so I listened to his advice, and I ended up going to the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale. And I spent about 3 years there. Later in life, I found out that the Count was Bill Black. It was his nom de plume.
Oh, okay.
So I think this was his way of getting me to go to art school.
Right, right.
So that was another great push for me from somebody. And that definitely helped me. I suggest going to art school for everyone. At the time, all I wanted to be was a penciler.
Right.
I was only interested in working in pencils, and that was it. And when you go to an art school like that, they want you to work in all different mediums. They want you to work in paint, markers, watercolor, airbrush, computer. That's where I learned my first computer class was way back then. Yeah, it was like Photoshop 1. Or no, it wasn't even Photoshop. It was Corel Draw?
Yes.
Wasn't that the very first drawing? That's what it was. It had like a pencil and a bucket. And that was it, man.
Was that on PC or Mac back then?
I don't even know. I don't remember what they had back then.
Okay.
But I had no idea how to use a computer. I didn't even know how to turn it on. I just knew how to go in there and use these tools to do the most simple, basic computer art processes. But when I was after I was graduating from the Art Institute, I decided to draw another Femme Force story. So I drew this 5-page story of this character, Nightveal. And she is like a... She's kind of like Raven. She's got magic abilities, and she's otherworldly, and she can go to other dimensions. And,
is she moody, too?
Very moody, very serious character. And I drew this scene of her. She has this cape. It's just, it's kind of like Raven.
Right.
It's, the cape is what has the power. It's the cape that has, that gives her all her power. And I have it that it comes alive while she's sleeping, and it tries to seduce her.
Okay.
And I spent like a good month drawing these 5 pages, so it looked great, man. I mean, from what I was drawing 3 years ago to this point,
right.
Night and day. So I send it to Bill, and I say, hey, Bill, I've been working, you know, I graduated art school. I have changed my art style. I want you to see what it looks like. So I send it to him, and of course, you know, they saw it, and they were like, it's great. But of course, I knew that I had spent nearly a month making these 5 pages look great.
Right.
So he says, you know what? We're thinking we'll make this a dream sequence in a full story. We want you to draw the other... How many pages in the comic book back then? 22.
22,
okay,
right.
So they wanted me to draw the other 18?
18 pages.
The other 18 pages. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I got a job. And he says, okay, one problem. We need you to draw this in about 20 days. I was like, oh, no. I spent all this time making these pages look perfect, and now I'm going to have to do this the way you're expected to do it.
Right.
One page a day at least. So I went about it. It obviously wasn't as good as the first 5 pages. And then I found out afterwards that he had actually done this on purpose, because he knew that I had spent a lot of time on these pages. And he said, yeah, Greg, I wanted you to understand that when you're working in this business, it's not necessarily about how great of an artist you are. It's about your ability to get your jobs done on time.
Right.
And make this a workable situation for me as a publisher. I got to be able to get these books out like clockwork.
Right.
Each month. And I was like, man, that sucks, but that was smart. It really, really got me into the mindset of what I would have to do to become a true comic book artist. And the other funny thing about that period, the 5 pages I did really good.
Right.
He had his best inker draw do it, and it looked so great. I was like so excited. But the other pages that I didn't do as well, and also, I guess since one section was a dream sequence, it was kind of okay to do the rest of the comic book with a different anchor.
Yeah.
But they sent it to some place down in South America where they were getting the pages inked for maybe $5 a piece. And let's just say it did not look quite as good.
Okay.
Yes. I'll be generous. It just did not look quite as good.
So...
And that's important because at that time I learned the importance of your inker.
Okay?
Because, you know, people are always making the joke that inkers are tracing, blah, blah, blah. But an inker is very important because, and I saw it right there in action. You know, a good inker is someone who can understand what you're trying to get across, and they can add or subtract where needed.
Right.
And that there's a great skill in that, you know? And I saw it happen right there. I saw my art being done expertly, and then my art being done kind of quick, where they're just hacking it out and trying to get it done. And ever since then, I've had a great appreciation for inkers.
So is that... Okay, so you're obviously known for doing a lot of covers for Marvel and DC. Mm-hmm. At that point, is that when you decided you wanted to concentrate on doing cover work, or did you still want to do interiors at that point?
Well, there's a misconception about my cover work. It appears that I waltzed into Marvel and became the cover artist, the superstar cover artist, and that's not how it happened at all.
Come on, we know that's how it works.
No, of course, it's simple. The way it really happened was... After working with AC Comics, we had the big speculator era where you had Malibu Comics,
yes.
Dagger Comics, I think there was one called Maverick Comics maybe, all these different
comics. Right.
And it was not too hard to get a job back then. And I spent the next 10 years in and out of independent comics, doing interiors. I've done interiors for Malibu. I did some for that very small company most people won't even remember, Dagger. And I did a Mortal Kombat book.
Okay.
And which was kind of interesting because they actually hired a painter to do the cover. It wasn't me, it was somebody else.
Right.
So I worked in and out of independent comics for about 10 years.
Do you remember what you did at Malibu?
Malibu, I did Hard Case. I did a little short story with a character called Casino. She's okay. like an assassin. And I also did the Mortal Kombat was actually
Malibu.
Oh, okay,
okay.
Yeah,
they had
the license for a while.
They had the license for Deep Space Nine, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the Malibu comics I collected were the Deep Space Nine ones. Okay.
Yeah, so those were good times, but the work was never constant. You know, you were always searching for the next job. I never had anything that was extended. So I was in and out of comics for 10 years. I started hitting conventions in 95. And so as I was going to all these conventions, I was meeting more and more people.
Right.
I met a writer named Jim Hudnall.
Okay.
And he had been doing this book, Espers, for a while. And he had seen my art. I met him at a Holiday Inn in Florida. And he said, hey, send me your stuff. I'll send it in. You know, see if anyone's interested. And that was largely the work I got at Malibu. And then he decided to crank up Espers again. And he put my name in to do the interiors.
Okay.
And I got the job. And I ended up doing about 12 issues in interiors with Espers.
Okay.
The first series was under Halloween Comics. And then I got another really big break because after Halloween Comics, Image picked up the book.
Oh, okay.
And we did a series for Espers with Image. And that's how the guys at Image got to know my name. And what's very important as a comic book artist is to build your name as a reliable person who's
right.
going to get these jobs done. Because there's plenty
right,
of flakes. We all know this. There's a lot of artists that are flakes. And you're always trying to prove that you can get the job done. So I managed to get all the Espers books in on time for Image. And that was one of the things that got me known as an artist who was reliable and was going to get the books done. So a couple years later, I was actually about to quit comics because I felt like I was trapped in independent comics. I'd been doing it for 10 years and didn't seem like any of the big publishers were taking note. And of course,
you still felt Image was independent at that point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You gotta understand, at that time, we're talking about late 90s.
Yeah.
Speculator era is over.
Right, right.
The comic industry is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
And all those companies that started folding
away. I mean, the comic industry at this point literally looks like it's gonna die. Anytime.
Right.
And it continued to look that way, I'd say, for the next 5 or 6 years. It was a pretty dire period in comic history. So
you were ready to quit comics?
Yeah, I was ready to quit comics. And I knew I had this painting technique that I'd been developing ever since art school. It's an airbrush technique.
Right.
I had done some of the Esper covers with it. And an amazing thing happened while I was doing Espers. I was using this stuff. It was a black and white comic book.
Right.
And I was using this stuff called Ziptone.
Ziptone, okay.
Yeah, Ziptone to do gray patterns in the artwork.
Okay.
What Ziptone is, it's a sticker with a dot pattern on it, or it might have any pattern.
Right.
You cut it out in the shape you want and stick it into the art. So, for instance, if you were doing, let's say you were doing Iron Man and you wanted his ears to look darker.
Right, right.
The ears on his helmet. You would take the Ziptone and it would put a 50% dot pattern on
okay.
it. And you can see it all throughout the 70s and 80s. It was used a lot
yes,
by a lot of
yes.
artists. So I was spending a lot of money on this. It was like $10 a sheet
oh,
to
wow.
buy these stickers. And I was using a lot of it to get my books finished. In addition, one of the characters named Maria had a floral pattern on her dress, and I had actually drawn it out and was making photocopies of it and then cutting it into the shape of her dress to keep repeating the pattern. It was very time intensive.
Right, right.
Because it was still faster than actually drawing her sweater over and over again. So finally, Jim said, he said, "Hey, Greg, do you know what Photoshop is?" And I was like, "No, what is that?" He said, "Well, it's a program that you use to draw. And you can do other things. You can manipulate colors and do all kinds of things with it. But if you were to get this, you would never have to use Zip-A-Tone again." He said, you can literally use this thing called a lasso, mask off the area.
Right, right.
And put the pattern right in there. And I said, "Really?" So that year at San Diego, I decided to stay over at his house for 3 weeks.
Okay.
He taught me how to use Photoshop.
Oh, wow.
And he was amazed. He said I was an absolute natural at it because... It turns out Photoshop lends itself very well to techniques you would use airbrushing.
Okay.
So if you're a watercolor painter or an acrylic painter, at this point you'd probably be better off with Painter the program.
Right, right.
Corel Painter. But doing an airbrush technique, it's very meticulous and it's got a photorealism to it.
Right.
Photoshop just lended itself perfect. And I just caught into this thing like boom, boom, boom. Everything made perfect sense. Instead of cutting out masks, you would cut masks out of like a vinyl sticker,
put
it down, and then airbrush. With Photoshop, you do that same thing with the lasso. You're just cutting out an area, and then your paint only goes in that area.
Right.
So it's funny to me. I'm known now as this color painter with all these vibrant colors.
Right.
But the original purpose of me buying Photoshop was to do cheesy... black and white special effects, like motion blur and lens flares, and to do these 50% gradient patterns.
Wow, I mean that's...
Yeah.
I didn't know. I mean, it's interesting.
It's crazy.
Because, I mean, your art today is so colorful, it pops.
Yep.
And it's just like, knowing that you used it to do black and white is...
Yep.
It's kind of interesting. So...
Well, the first couple of covers that I did for Esper's, I did airbrush on paper.
Okay.
And then I said, "Well, wait a minute. If I can do all this black and white stuff on computer, why not try color?"
Right.
So slowly but surely, I started using the computer to bolster the pencils.
Right.
And then in some cases, I would go completely computer, but I ended up not liking going completely computer because the art was starting to develop characteristics of Photoshop.
Right, right.
Of digital painting, and it was starting not to look like, I felt like it wasn't looking like me anymore.
Yeah.
It was looking more computer and less human. And since then, I've kind of stayed with the half traditional, half digital.
Right.
But the truth is, I do my art in all different ways. Some paintings, I will do a very detailed drawing. Other paintings, I will do a minimal drawing. I might even sketch it out on computer. So
right.
It's done in a lot of ways. But slowly but surely, I started developing my cover style that I'm using today on the Esper's book. So the next step that happened, I'm starting to realize that I may quit comics because the industry looks worse and worse, as I was saying. And I'm just about to quit, but then I said to myself, "You know what? I've been trapped in this black and white world for about 11 years.
Right.
No one's even seen my color stuff.
Right.
As far as doing the interior of a comic book. And this is around the time of, Alex Ross is about to pop up on the scene. So I'm saying to myself, you know, no one's ever seen me paint interiors. I owe it to myself to at least do one color comic book before I quit and go off to do whatever.
Right.
So I contacted Image, and I said, "Hey, I would like to do my own comic book. I want to do it fully painted. It's going to be called Judge. It's about monster hunters, essentially.
It's
kind of like a Hellboy thing almost." And they immediately said, "Oh yeah, sure, absolutely."
Huh.
So at that point, I was very grateful that I had done the Esper's work, and they knew that I wasn't bullshitting, and I was going to get this thing done. It was really going to happen. Because that was one of the big problems in the late 90s, was just getting guys to get their stuff done on time, you remember all the comic books back then were late. There were some books that people said were going to come out, and then you would not see them for 8 months.
Yes.
Remember
yes.
all that? I mean, that doesn't happen as much now, but back then it was like normal. It was the norm back then. So they said, yeah, sure. So I understood that all these people were not coming through and finishing their comic books, or they would do one comic book and then not do any follow-up issues.
Right.
You had that situation going on too. So I promised Image, I said, you know what? I want to do a 3-issue miniseries, and I'm going to finish all 3 before we publish. That way there's no issue of me not getting the book done.
Okay.
So it was 77 full-color painted pages, all digitally painted.
Wow.
It took me a year and a half to finish the comic book. So I went a year and a half not getting paid,
right.
not knowing what it's going to sell,
right.
nothing. But it was a great, great period of experimentation and learning what I could do with the computer, and it's right. probably the most important thing I've ever done in my comic career is this book Judge, and I wrote it also. So I get the book done, and it did pretty well. It did enough that you could live on it barely.
Okay.
Well, now came time to do the I wanted to do the second series of it.
Right.
And I talked to Valentino at Image, and he said that he didn't think that the book would be viable for a second series.
Right.
Now, I knew nothing about business back then. I didn't realize that, yes, when you do the second series, chances are it's going to come in with lower numbers.
Right.
I didn't understand that. So the whole thing was very... you know, it was just a defeat to me. So he suggested that I get a writer to help me with it, like a name writer.
Okay.
And I was in the process of doing that. And at that time, I had just gotten married to Betsy.
Right.
And we didn't have a lot of money back then. And she had agreed that we would have our honeymoon the week before San Diego Comic-Con. And then end up at Comic-Con and do whatever I had to do there. So you
got a good one.
Yes, God bless her. So so we get there, and it's just the book's doing awful. We did terrible at that show. It was really bad. But a guy came up to me at the show. And remember, I did this Judge book with the idea that I would do this as my last hurrah.
Right.
And then I was going to quit.
Right.
I'm a married man. I got to get a real job now, okay?
Yes.
So we're at the show. And a guy comes up from a movie poster company in Beverly Hills.
Okay.
And he says, hey Greg, we really like your artwork. We would like you to come work for us. We want you to move out to California. We'll start you on a salary, and you'll be working for this movie poster company, and we are going to be working on the Hulk movie poster. You'll be working on the Hulk movie poster. I was like, oh, really?
Okay.
So that was great. That we got this information on the first day. So I'm sitting in the booth. I'm there with Brian and David Mack.
Okay.
And this is before Brian became a writer at Marvel. Brian Bendis. This is before he had become a writer. We're all there just trying to make our way.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, Greg, we're going to a dinner tonight with Joe Quesada. You want to come with us? And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. So I went to the dinner, and I had met Joe previously.
Okay.
At shows down in Florida, and he really liked my artwork, and he would always give me an editor at DC to send my artwork to, and it always didn't work out. I'd send them the artwork, and they're like, yeah, it's okay, but you got to do this and that. And after a while, I started to feel like Joe was giving me all these contacts, and I was blowing it.
Right.
So I had some trepidations about going to the dinner because, you know, it's just. You feel like you've had quite a few failures, and he's kind of helping, and it's just not working out.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, okay, you know, I'll go to the dinner, and we'll see Joe. So we get to the dinner, and we're having conversation and eating, and then Joe asks me, he says, hey, Greg, did anybody from Marvel ever call you? And I'm like, no. I said, all the contacts you're giving me are like DC editors.
Right. Says,
well, I'll tell you what, this week, you're going to get a call. And I'm like, okay. And what I didn't realize is he had just become editor-in-chief at Marvel.
Right, right.
So when he says you're going to get a call, you're going to get a call. But I went home not thinking anything was going to happen.
Right.
I thought, I don't know what I thought. I thought I was going to take this job out in California. So we get home, and on Monday, I'm already making phone calls and figuring out where we're going to live in California and get the flight out to go.
Right,
and
right.
Sure enough, I get a phone call from Marvel. And I believe it was either Nancy Quesada or Polly Watson. I can't remember which editor it was. But they said, hey, Greg, would you like to do a Spider-Man cover? So this is like the phone call I've been waiting for 11 years, and here it is. And I have to decide, do I want to take this salary job out in California and have security?
Yes.
It's going to be a 9-to-5. Or do I want to chase the dream once again? They're only promising me one damn comic book. You know, it doesn't mean anything. I could turn it in, and I could blow it like all the previous times, and nothing's going to happen. And obviously, you know what I chose.
The cover.
I chose to chase the dream. And the first comic book cover I did was for a Spider-Man book, Spider-Man backpack books. There are these little tiny books that I guess they were intending to sell for kids, and you could throw them in your backpack.
Right,
backpack.
Right.
I mean, they're reprint books. And then after that, they gave me a couple more. I did X-Men. So they liked the first one.
Right.
After that, I did X-Men, a couple of other ones. Then they put me on X-Men Universe. And then I started to realize, I said, wait a minute. Every book they're giving me is a reprint. It's
right,
a reprint
right.
book. Because the backpack books are reprint. X-Men Universe were reprints of X-Men comic books, and
right,
then I was
right.
starting to get a little worried that they didn't trust me.
Right.
You know, they didn't want to put me on a big one, but soon after that, I got a call from Brian, and he at this point, he was working at Marvel, and he was already getting very big
at
Marvel Comics. I mean, it was almost immediate for him. And he said, hey, Greg, would you like to do interiors on Elektra?
Uh-huh.
He's about to do his Elektra series. And I said, yeah? I said, what's the deadline on it? And he said, well, you're going to need to get the first book done in about 3 months, and then you'll have to put out a book every month after that. And they wanted me to paint it. They wanted me to paint it, and I was
paint
like...
Paint it as well?
I paint the interiors, and I was like, oh my goodness. I said, there's no way, Brian. I said, this opportunity of a lifetime, but I can't do it. It's just, it's going to look bad is what's going to happen.
Right, right.
I'm gonna cut every corner. And you know what? Even looking bad, if I did it as fast as I could, I still don't know if I could finish a painted book every month.
Right.
That would have been really tough. But thankfully, they gave me the covers. They gave me the cover assignment on that book. And I did the first 22 issues of Elektra. And that was really what got me on the scene, mainstream.
Right.
After that, everybody knew my work. And then shortly after that, they got me on the Emma Frost books.
Right.
And I would say Emma Frost was where I really turned the corner. The Emma Frost covers was when people started saying, you know, hey, wow, who's this guy? This is really awesome. And I still get people to this day that just, you know, they just go crazy for the Emma covers. They love them.
So you went from the guy who couldn't draw women to the guy who got known for drawing Elektra and Emma Frost.
Yes, yes. Which I always find fascinating because the work I was given at Marvel was almost all female books.
Right.
You know, it was all female books. I did Elektra first, then Emma Frost, then they put me on She-Hulk. That was a lot of fun because there's a lot of comedy involved there. And then finally they put me on Miss Marvel, and by the time I had run through this gamut of comic books, I was pretty much known as the girl artist.
Right, right. The girly artist.
The girly artist. But the problem with that is Marvel's best characters are male characters. Spider-Man, Captain America, Thor. So if you're talking about building a career, it's much better to get on the guy comic books. And at that point, I don't think anybody was even thinking about that because the girls art I was painting were so great. It was like, man, you gotta have Greg paint the girl characters. And also, what's typical with a lot of good girl artists is they draw terrible men.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go down the list of your favorite good girl artists, not all of them, but a lot of them don't draw the greatest male characters. So that's a that's something that sticks in people's heads automatically. It's just something they
so people assumed you couldn't draw the male characters.
So I'm sure some people did, yes. Yeah. So the good thing was, I started doing these, as I said, I started doing conventions in 95, and around 99 or 2000, I started going to wizard shows.
Right.
And my art caught on over there, and they asked me to do some wizard covers.
Right.
So the first wizard cover was female, of course, because that's all I know for drawing. So I did a lecture. Then after that, they had me do an InQuest Gamer cover. And it was a cover of Sarah Angel. She's a character from Magic the Gathering.
Yes.
And in the game, she wears these giant football pad shoulder things, and she has a gigantic Viking helmet with horns.
Right.
And it's just not a great design. No. So they said, hey, Greg, you know what? Why don't you just do your own thing, man? Run with it. Redesign this character. So I did this very sexy angel cover. Her armor is all golden, and it's based off of Indian bridal jewelry.
Right.
And she just looks really, she's smoking hot. Well, I found out later that a lot of people had called in to complain about it. Probably a lot of moms.
Okay.
It's InQuest Gamer. It's a book that has, probably at the time, it had Pokemon and the Yu-Gi-Oh games and all that stuff.
Yes.
So anyway, they got a call. And now, I don't know this for sure. I've never verified it, but it just makes sense to me. They told me that they did get calls and people were complaining. And I noticed that after that cover, Wizards started asking me to do only male characters.
Okay.
From then on. And I've done about 15 to 18 Wizard covers. I'm one of the I'm one of the top
wizard.
I'm one of the people that has done the most wizard covers.
Right, right.
And I probably did it in the shortest amount of time because I didn't start doing wizard covers until issue 119.
Right.
So I did quite a few in a very short period of time, and from then on they had me do only guys, and it was through Wizard that people started realizing I could draw male characters. Slowly but surely, after about 5 years, I get just about equal amount of calls for both. I mean, as you know, with the GameStop books I'm doing
right
now, it's all male characters, you know, it's Wolverine, Spider-Man.
So is that InQuest cover, is that the one that was the cover of your art book?
Yes, it's the same one.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right, because I think people are familiar with that piece.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, even though I took some heat for that cover, that was definitely a turning point.
Right.
Because I do believe that was the cover where they still wanted me to do artwork for them, but they wanted to steer away from the girl art to keep the heat off. You know, once the heat starts, you want it to cool down and then maybe do it again later. And I think from that point, I probably did 10 male covers, like Hulk. We did a Captain America movie poster. We did some Spider-Man stuff.
Right.
And I think I only did one female cover in that whole period. It was Spider-Woman as a Skrull.
Okay. And I've seen that piece.
Yeah, I believe that was the only girl they ever asked me to draw again. And it turned out to my great advantage. So that's why I don't really worry about people online complaining about stuff. Because if something bad happens to you or something that you think is negative, it's usually best to just ride it out, see where it's going to take you. It usually just turns you in a different direction. And I all the young artists that come to my table, that's what I tell them. I say, if something bad happens to you in life and it just seems like it's just nothing but negative, just wait a little while. You got to be patient, because eventually it's really just sending you in a different direction.
Right.
And if you're as good as you think you are, you're going to come through no matter what.
All right, so I'm going to ask you something, and you know, you get a lot of, we all know that you get a lot of flack online. I think I read an article, I don't remember where it was posted, talking about the most sexist artists in comics, and your name was on that list, and
right,
they had quite a few of your pieces on there, which, in all honesty, they're looking at wasn't as bad as some of the other stuff I've seen. Like, you don't draw the booty shots and those kinds of things. What do you think when you see stuff like that pop up?
Well, I've been doing this for 20 years. And at first, you look into it. and you end up reading everything.
Right.
Because it's this new thing, and it's like, oh my God, these people are saying bad things about you. What are they saying?
Right,
and
right.
You go online and you read it all, and it just makes you feel bad. And then over time, you start to realize that it's not worth it to even read the stuff.
Right.
And you stop paying attention to it. And then over time, you just don't even care anymore. I literally don't care.
Well, I think that's a great attitude to have. I mean, you can't... I don't think you can let those comments influence you, because then you're going to start... It's going to start affecting your art.
Yeah.
And as an artist, you know, I say this all the time on the podcast, art's truth. And if you're now editing yourself because you're afraid someone online is going to call you sexist or, you know, any ist you can think of,
yeah,
it's not, then you're not being true anymore. You're pandering to minority voices. So, you know, I mean, that's... So I think that's just, you know, I think it's the right attitude for artists to have. Like, you know, you're doing your art, you know?
Yeah, one of my talents that's not really artistic, I have a really good ability to purge bad stuff out of my mind. It's good. I think it's good to keep a journal.
Right.
Because I started realizing when something bad happens to me, not, you know, disregarding people complaining about artwork. I mean, anything. Let's
right,
say your
right.
car breaks down.
Yeah.
I started to find myself thinking about this stuff, but it was mostly because I was trying to remember it all. Because you feel like there's so many bad things happening.
Right.
That you need to remember it all so you don't do it again.
Or, yeah.
Or if somebody... If you're talking to somebody, you want to be able to remember it all. And I realized it was making me very unhappy. So I just started a journal.
Okay.
And I'd say for like the past 10 years...
Right.
Everything that bugs me, I've just been writing down in this journal. And then I immediately... It just purges out of my brain and I don't even think about it. Because in my mind, I know it's written down. I'm not going to forget it. I can always go back and read it.
I hope my name isn't in that journal.
Just... two or three times.
So then I guess, you know, what's, you talked about this a little bit. What is like the main advice you give to any artist who's starting out?
Well, my main piece of advice, and it seems very simplistic, but it's something you got to have at your core. You have to have a sense that you're not going to give up.
Okay.
You have to think in your mind that every time you want to give up, and I've considered quitting the comic industry probably 7 or 8 different times.
Right.
And I explained one of them to you in the story, you know, when I had to decide between the poster company and comics.
Right, right.
You have to have it in your mind that you're not going to give up, and you have to think, every time I think about giving up, there was 100 other people thinking the same thing, and they did.
Okay.
The only answer is to go forward.
Right.
If there's explosions happening everywhere, left, right, behind you, don't go towards the explosions. Go, where is the gold? Where's the finish line? Just go straight to it. Make tunnel vision and go right there. The
All
other
right.
thing I tell them, as I mentioned before, when bad things happen to you, you've heard the old saying, what does not kill you makes you stronger.
Right.
Okay. So, if something happens to you that you're feeling is bad, you can't let it take a hold of you.
Right.
And cause you to change. Because I've found that in life, these things that you are initially thought were bad turn out to be good things in the end. Bill Black.
Right.
Firing me. He fired me. When
okay.
I was 17, poor little me. But it made me go to art school.
Right.
And learn how to do my painting style.
And there you go, ladies and gentlemen. The gregarious Greghorn.
Can I just say, it was so moving.
Yes.
I laughed. I cried. It was better than Cats.
It was better than Cats. Yes.
Hey, I've been in Cats. Jeez.
Well, then it's not very hard of a comparison to make.
No, it's not. You remember... you remember doing Cats? having to wear that smelly outfit. Have you heard that before? That on Broadway, they actually don't wash the suits because they're painted.
Well, because the way that they're made, they cannot be machine washed or even dry cleaned.
Right.
There is no feasible way to do so without destroying the costumes.
So they basically spray them down with Febreze. Really, so you know when they're singing Memories, they're really crying from the smell. So
I would say those costumes that show predates Febreze. So I wonder what they did before that.
Nose plugs.
And by the way, because everyone will take note that interview kind of ended slightly abruptly.
You missed the most exciting parts.
Well, like I said, that we recorded it at the diner, and my phone messed up apparently like the last 10 minutes of the show.
What would a superhero speak episode be without technical difficulties, though, Dave?
Yep.
I don't know. That would be it's a horrible thought.
Yes.
I think we would have
to. Gives me chills.
We would just have to stop doing it at that point, you know? So what we missed, he was telling us about some of his stuff that he's working on right now. One of the big things that he's working on, for those who don't know, he's currently the designated artist for all of the Marvel comics that are sold through GameStop. He does all the alternate covers for those. And we also, of course, as we always do on the show, we talked about where can you find Greg online? And his official website is GregHornJudge.com, and you can go there, but it's not as updated as we would like to be. He's also on Twitter at GregHorn, but the best place to find out what's going on with Greg is go onto that Facebook, ladies and gentlemen, and look for GregHorn Art and like that page. And he shares, you know, all the stuff that he's working on is on there. He talks about the shows that he's going to be at. All that fun stuff. And he posts a lot of embarrassing stories about himself and his kids. So it's wonderful. And as somebody who is a friend with him on Facebook, I can attest to there isn't anything that he doesn't share on there that he doesn't also share on his friend page. So it's not like you're missing anything if you're not on his friend page. And, you know, he doesn't accept friend requests. You have to like his fan page. So look for him there. And So I hope we all learned a little something this evening, gentlemen.
I did. Yes. I learned we can throw together an intro and outro in under 10 minutes.
Yes.
Peel back the curtain, folks.
Yes. What was that about a fourth wall? I don't know.
No, it's breaking the fourth Barry. And on one final note, totally unrelated to Greg. If you had listened to us previously on Rhymes with Geek, you should be aware at this point that Rhymes with Geek, was absorbed by theouthousers.com. So Rhymes with Geek will be up for a little bit while.
I knew this longer. Whole thing was going down the toilet.
What was that?
I said, I knew this whole thing was going down the toilet.
Yes, exactly. So Rhymes with Geek will stay up for a little bit while. There will be archived episodes on there. You can still go back on that website and listen to old archived of our show. I know Comic Reflections is on there. Real Books Don't Have Batman. We're on that site. A lot of great podcasts on there. But theouthousers.com, they have welcomed us with open arms, and we will now be available through there every week, just like we are on superheroespeak.com, Comic Related, and Comics Podcast Network. So if you're discovering us through the Outhousers, welcome. We hope that you enjoy many more years of wonderful interviews and craziness like this.
And we're sorry in advance.
Yes. So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, as I say each and every week, don't let your cape be caught in the door. Have a good week.
Okay, now it's my turn. Okay, what are you doing? Taking over Dad's mic so I can be part of Superhero Speak. Duh.
Well, there are better ways to join the conversation.
Really? Like what?
Well, you can interact with them on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even Pinterest.
Wait, people use Pinterest? And what's Google+?
I don't know, something to do with circles. Anyway, you can also see all their posts, including comic book reviews, on their website, where you can also sign up for their mailing list. Cool! Yep, are you still going to try to hijack Dad's mic?
Nope, I'm going to try to answer the Stump the Geek question.
Nice. So who do you think would win in a fight between Rainbow Dash and Squirrel Girl?
Oh, that's a hard one. Oh no, Dad's waking up. My freaking eyes!
Oh, what are you guys doing? That cape's going to get caught in the door.